You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is M. Edmonds. M., it's good to have you here today.
Thanks very much. I'm really glad to be here.
So, Em, the way we start the show is with a big question, which you can take as philosophically or however you want. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to or the things you do or labels you wear to start the conversation?
Okay, well, I would say that I am a very curious person. And I like to learn pretty much about the things that are around me. And I like to learn about people and their stories. I imagine that's pretty similar to you. I certainly like to enjoy things. I love food and colors. And I actually really like to see other people enjoying things. It's one of the things that motivates me to pay attention to beauty or the arts. And to encourage other people in those efforts. It really excites me and gives me a lot of hope to see people involved in those projects. That's just a start. That's right. One thing.
Right. And so you are a serious observer, but you're also a serious participant.
Yes.
So how is it that you participate in how is it that you shape your life and not just enjoy what you're observing or note it?
Well, that's absolutely right. I guess I always had a really active imagination, and so the curiosity would end up resulting in planting a little garden out in the woods when I was a little kid, or I did a lot of reading, and then I ended up doing a lot of writing, and I wrote poetry and I wrote songs my whole life. And then as I got older and had more of my own autonomy, I would sometimes organize things. I organized a community garden in Albany. I organized food drives and flower sales and art shows and with my art and other people's art. And then I really loved school, because school was a better place to be than home when I was a little girl. Home was not a good place. And school just had all these opportunities. So I got really involved with different clubs and drama club and art club and stuff. And then as I got older and older, I don't know if you'd know about the Shakespeare Troupe.
No.
Oh, okay. I kind of produced and formed this little Shakespeare troupe in Ithaca for 10 years. And it was called Black Umbrella. And it was just, you know, I had no idea at first what it would become or what I was doing. I had been involved in theater in Albany, but then got involved in the Shakespeare, in forming it with my son. And then I hired a director, and then we cast the plays, and we got grants from the Community Arts Partnership, and all these people came out of the woodwork to be involved, and they were really talented. And it was just way more than the sum of its parts, and I just felt so grateful. And that just kind of really helped me understand that one of my favorite positions or roles is to like facilitate other people coming forward with their gifts. And people went on to like theater schools and, you know, troupes in big cities and acting career. It was funny. It was wonderful.
Wow. It's like a cross between being a catalyst and the ringmaster in a three-ring circus.
I prefer to think of it as an instigator.
Instigator. A catalyst works pretty good.
Yes, it does. Yeah. It's a good...
So instigator. Yeah, no. And get people started. You brought some music with you, and we're going to start with Nina Simone and Feeling Good.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about that before we play it?
Just to start out with, you know, Nina Simone, she just touches so many people, and she's such an incredible inspiration. And I wanted to start out with this particular song because it is so lovely, but she goes through the whole range of human experience, and I could have chosen a bunch of songs, but let's start with this.
Right, and that is her gift.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, and a bold world for me. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine, you know how I feel. Oh, freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is M. Edmonds. So, M., looking at the life that you value now, that you love now, what were some of the experiences? What are the things that you had to go through to come to discover that this is the life you want to and love to live? Mm-hmm. You've already started with some of them, but yeah. what were some of the focusing events or experiences?
Well, it was a real mixed bag. Like I imagine most, yeah, exactly. And I grew up in a pretty rural area outside of Albany, and we grew up on an old farm. We were not farmers, but it was a lot of acres with ponds and a barn and cornfields. And I spent a ton of time outside. I had five brothers and sisters. And I just really, partly through being outside, partly through my mother's interest in nature, mm-hmm. I just was so in love with the woods and fields and the stream in back of the house. And really, my heart was opened, I think, sometimes by that.
Where were you in the birth order of those?
I was number five out of six. So yeah. It was like I was kind of lost in the middle, but which was kind of good. But I wasn't too lost because I was a little too loud. I was the child who spoke up and talked back and tried to defend the rest of us, which didn't work out always so well, but
but you had this great expanse of space that you went out into.
Yes, and that really probably saved me, and then also school. But there was just a lot of pain at home that mm-hmm. I imagine, you know, again, like, you know, pretty much every kind of abuse that would happen to a child was happening in my family of origin. And it took a long, long time and a lot of work and a lot of help to work on and heal from a lot of that stuff. And mm-hmm. that does definitely inform what I do and who I am in the world. Mm-hmm. Because I want to be able to help in the process so that people have ways to heal and ways mm-hmm. to be safe and ways to be able to turn around and grow.
Right, right. And it seems that you said that the vast expanse of outdoors saved you. I mean, I my experience on the farm, though it wasn't the degree of abuse that you're alluding to, I could pour myself out of the house across the prairie and end up in any one of a number of places if the animals weren't too scary or mm-hmm. attack oriented for whatever reason. What about that was healing for you or was saving for you?
Well, I think, let me see. I guess I used to take this little rowboat and push it off into the pond and just sit on the stern of it, like balanced over the edge of it with an oar and just like row myself around these mm-hmm. little streams and just so much beauty. And the plants, I fell in love with plants. Somewhere early in my explorations of thought and morality, spirituality, I decided that, I was very, after giving it a short trial, organized religion seemed to be really bizarre to me and not real and not safe and not honest. But now I try to have a more open mind about what other people are doing. But I did find a spirituality in just the renewal of the earth and the seasons. I became extremely, just enamored with and in love with natural processes and very worried about the environment too.
Right, right, right. And the image that struck me initially, sitting on the stern of that boat and paddling yourself around, but you're in one world where you have no choice about who you're with or what you see so much. And then you're in another world where it's all your choice.
Absolutely.
And it's not imagination because it's not generated in the mind, but the mind chooses it.
That is true. And that's a big deal.
And so many kids who are going through, whether it's abuse or just the tension of a family in crisis or whatever, need that space to just...
to have some control and some mastery and some freedom and safety.
Right.
Yeah, and I was very much of a tomboy, but I was a little wispy, asthmatic, skinny tomboy, if you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I had curly hair that was almost always had grass and burrs in it.
Matted for whatever reason.
Yes. Yep. And I collected birds' nests and fossils in a box. And I had some many, many lovely, lovely memories. And even within my family, even though there was difficulty, my mother was very open and curious about the natural world, and I had some shifting alliances and connections with my brothers and sisters. We're all very close now.
Well, I mean, part of growing up in a family with many siblings is learning how to triangulate.
Oh, absolutely. And how to hide your precious stuff and everything.
Right. Right, right. And to know who you can share your being hurt with and who you can't.
Yes.
All those sorts of things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's extraordinarily sweet. So that opened you up to a kind of healing and a kind of experience of shaping the world you live in, that I see that you brought forward. What other kinds of experiences help to kind of give you the skills that you need to be able to act on that with others?
Well, I think that I went to a small rural public school, and I had extraordinary teachers. And I had, yucky ones too, or ones that were not very well behaved and, didn't know how to deal with children. But I had a number of mentors who just really profoundly affected my vision and my heart. And I remember one in particular, Art Willis, and then a number of other people. And Art is no longer with us, but in a way, his name, Art, like, right, conjures up who he was. He just was open and curious about life. He taught anthropology, of all things, in a high school, which isn't a typical high school subject. And I decided I was going to be an anthropologist, and pretty much, almost sort of am, and long, long path of schooling. School, I just wish everybody could have, really, I really wish everyone could have the opportunities that I've had and the mentorship that I've had, because it's just opened up a lot.
Well, the adolescent that you were going into relationship with these mentors, what changed? How did those mentors impact you specifically?
Let me see. Well, they recognized my talents, and they put them forward. Like when I was writing, I got a lot of attention, and people would read my poetry to the class, or they organized poetry readings, and I was part of that. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like what I do now. Right. In a certain, you know, so I, in a way, I've learned it from them. And just also a lot of listening and a lot of acknowledging the reality of being a person and going through pain. Like, just so some of it is a little bit like ministry in a way.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Teachers do a lot.
Right. And what I'm hearing is that they had the good sense to recognize your curiosity, so they didn't try to teach you so much as they tried to cheer you on in what you were doing anyway.
I think so, but also I think...
Where did they push you? Yeah, yeah.
Let me see. I think I think I got pushed a little more as I got older, mm-hmm. which is good and fine. And I mean, I've just recently finished a PhD. I don't know.
Which is a push in and of itself, of all
and
sorts.
And I'd say during that period, my mentor, again, I had excellent mentors. And the areas where I got pushed the most was in the areas where I was being either righteous or arrogant, which are things that I generally don't think are... You know, I don't think they're useful.
They're not what you aspire to be, and but they're sometimes our default positions when we get defensive.
Yeah, when you start to think, hey, I know something about something or whatever. Right. And especially when there's any sort of opposition, and there always is, you're right, it's defensive. And to see the grace with which my mentors, especially in graduate school, were able to even deal with my... my rigidness sometimes, a very gentle, like, well, I want you to look at this. I want you to think about your attitude here about this other position and what is informing it, you know, and just so I really am inspired by that.
And they taught directly to you in that way. Mm-hmm. I, as a junior high student, early high school student, I would do student government campaign posters with the black power fist and say, you know, student power through student government kinds of stuff. Uh-huh. And their way of managing this kid who could have kind of become really kind of at odds with the administration was to assign me the task of rewriting the district's code of conduct manual.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which
that's really
I didn't
funny.
Realize at the time was a total way of co-opting me. But at the same time, it was a way of letting me see, this is why we need some structure here. Mm-hmm. And how would you say it? And how would you talk through with your peers to make it happen?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So when you were talking about mentors and their role with you, I was thinking of Walt Steffen, who was the school principal who put me on that agenda.
Yeah.
So you brought some more music with you. What should we play next?
Let me see. How about that Devo?
Okay. And do you want to say something now or after we play it?
Well, I wrote to you in the note that I kind of see this as a song about privilege and inequality. And the video is fantastic, and it really informs you more a little bit about what the song is. And so, they're singing about, the title is It's a Beautiful World. And it's actually you know, it's a beautiful world depending on your position and your privilege, partly. And there's a lot of beauty in it for everyone, but sometimes there's real inequalities about who gets to experience ease and leisure and pleasure. And I'm interested in kind of evening the playing field a little and making sure that everyone has access to the good things in life.
Right, right. And also, as you were saying before, that we see what people are doing. I have a painting in my living room of a child who's carrying plantains on his head. This child is far too young to be working like that, but it's smiling with a mischievous smile as though, even though I have to work like this, mm-hmm. I'm going to take some pleasure out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is M. Edmonds. So, Em, you and I have one thing in common. We did graduate school as graduate school for different reasons, but that has been a signature piece of your life. It's a big chunk of your life.
Oh, yeah.
What was that about?
Well, I inspired by that childhood in the woods, blah, 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 and that, you know, being...
And anthropology.
Yes, anthropology, absolutely. So I was very interested and in love with plants and the natural world, but I also was, interested in anthropology. So I ended up coming here to be a graduate student after SUNY Albany and working my way through undergraduate school with several jobs. And I came here to study botany and ethnobotany, how other cultures use plants medicinally.
So you were taking your observations and looking at how other people do their observations.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was very interested in particularly how people use plants for women's health, mm-hmm. And birth and maybe birth control, etc. So I came here. I was accepted, and I came here in the mid-'80s. And it was fascinating, and I was having a wonderful time, but it was also a struggle, and I was a somewhat misbehaving young person doing a lot of things on the side, including music and singing in a band.
Right, and you're not just going, you're having a good time and going to grad school on the side.
Sort of, indeed.
Or maybe which the balance may shift.
And then that all kind of went kaplowy or kaboom when I had this being enter my life, and it was my son. And so I had to reconfigure everything, because I needed to drop out and raise him. And I was on my own. And there was some hard things that happened there, and I'm going to just mention them because people can grow and heal from these. There was some violence during my pregnancy, and I had to take measures and deal with the police, etc. And I had a broken nose and a black eye. And then I was raising this baby, and I went back to nursing school, and then I became a midwife nurse practitioner over several years while working at the same time. And he was growing up, you know, going from baby to a little kid, and he was such an amazing, friendly little baby and little kid. And we just, you know, we had to do the little family unit. And right. That was just, what a journey, an unexpected, amazing, hard and wonderful journey. And that's where I did want to say this. I could have taken this whole time just naming people and organizations that helped me and that helped us. Mm-hmm. There's so much help that I got. And even so, it was hard and stressful. Even if you have two parents, sure. Raising a kid is no, you know, light affair. So we were really, really helped. And then down the road, after I've been working in this little family planning clinic for many years, I ended up being able to go back to graduate school. And what I wanted to look at were the social barriers to really important health decisions that people try to make, and particularly in women's health. So I'd had this very good fortune to be able to work with a mentor, Lindy Williams and Alika Basu and Kath March and Tom Herschel, and they were my mentors through that. And I ended up doing research in India, in Delhi, India, for mm-hmm. on and off over 8 years. And what an amazing journey. And it was a total struggle at times.
Right.
But I met amazing people. And I'm so grateful to have had that opportunity, and alarmed that I actually finished last year.
right. But, I mean, it's when you talked about the struggle to successfully get through the pregnancy, have the child, the help to raise it. But you also, while you came from a family which gave you a fair amount of freedom in the out of doors, it didn't give you a lot of real grounding in how to raise a family.
Mm, that's really interesting. That's one of the areas where I also got a lot of help. I actually called up the public health department and asked for a public health nurse to come to my house when he was a baby to make sure I was doing everything right.
Right.
And then I went to the cooperative extension and I took parenting classes. I took 3 parenting classes at different points, mm-hmm. just to try to understand. And also probably because I'm a person who reads books and takes classes, so it's kind of silly. But it helped me a lot.
Not if you need the relational piece.
Yeah.
You can read all the books in the world, but until you have a person there parallel, right. Doing what you were, yeah.
Now, my mother was a really excellent parent, but, you know, she had 6 kids.
Right.
She was overwhelmed.
Right.
So I learned a great deal about how to listen to and communicate with a child, a baby, and then a child, and then an older child, how to, you know, listen in a way that, and how to discipline in a constructive way. Like, those things are not instinctual. I mean,
not unless you've really witnessed it done very well,
right,
a long time.
But that's
yeah.
learning.
Yeah.
And, that's and then I was on the WIC program for a while, but then I ended up being a nurse and working at the WIC program and being able to, you know, work with the families and say to them, yep, I was on this program too. And WIC is Women, Infants, and Children. It's a food supplement program. And it really is highly important and successful and under, you know, not as well known success in our system.
Yeah. In the deep red state of Missouri, one of the things they do, a couple of things reasonably well, which is youth incarceration and making alternatives to youth incarceration.
Oh, that's
but
good.
Also, but in terms of and making it so that there are activities that help kids come out with some skills and some self confidence and alternatives. But the other thing that they do is parents as teachers.
Nice.
So once a month from the at the birth of the child, and then once every 3 months, and then once every 6 months, and then once every year, up until the child is about 5 or 6 years old, so that the parents are learning what to look for, and they're, you know, and that's just an enormous gift of confidence. I mean, I grew up helping to take care of the babies and small children my older sisters had, so it wasn't as unfamiliar to me, but they gave me factual details and information that I hadn't heard that way before, and it's really helpful.
Absolutely.
Hugely helpful.
Yeah.
So when you got to the point where things were stable enough and you could go back and look at the PhD again, who did you contact? How did you make that connection? And how did people step onto your side in the way that they did?
I actually, let me see. I had done the nursing program at TC3, which was great. And then I worked. And then I went back to SUNY Stony Brook for the midwifery nurse practitioner program and worked at the place where I'm still working now for a while. And then I started, you know, stumping around and sending emails and talking to different people. And I need to mention here, I have this very, very dear friend who passed away a couple years ago now. His name is Bernd Lambert, and he is an elderly gentleman. And he was a professor of mine in anthropology at Cornell before my son was born, and we became close friends. And he just, you know, we would get together and talk about the world and its history. And he had escaped with his parents from Nazi Germany, actually Bulgaria at the time, over the Trans-Siberian Railroad.
Wow.
And he was just a profoundly important person in my life. And
I knew him as an undergrad. I was an anthropology
Lambert.
Major. And Kath March was my undergraduate thesis advisor.
Oh, yeah,
advisor.
Yeah. That's great. So you get where I'm coming from. And so a combination of him, a little bit of in touch with Kath March, although later I got closer to her because I was working with her as she was one of my mentors. I very much wanted to go back and finish. I actually... Yeah, so that was an ongoing conversation. It was such an amazing thing to go back. And also that little detour, that huge detour, but that detour into poverty, because for a while I had very, very little and got some social services, which I'm very grateful for. I never want to forget how hard that was.
Right.
And I never want to forget that there's a lot of people who feel like they've lost their dreams or never had the luxury of a bigger dream. And I never want to forget people who don't have the opportunities. Because I had a good education and, you know, I was able to be, you know, pursue education and be somewhat successful. And I just never want to forget how important it is to make sure that everyone has more opportunities.
Right. I mean, and you're trying to say clearly you had situational poverty as opposed to generational poverty to deal with. But the other piece that you're not quite saying but is incredibly powerful is that you remember how hard it was but it's not shameful.
No, but I did feel ashamed. I hate to say that, but No. In fact, I was also angry and bitter. And, you know, I felt darn sorry for myself a lot of the time. And that is a really bad place to be. And getting help, I was able, you know, to move out of that.
When did you realize you had some choice about the shame and this and the kind of a certain understandable self-pity?
That's a good question. I think the thing that was I'm trying to think here. I think I was able to get a fair amount of therapy, which and these people were very skilled, especially a couple of them, and that just made a huge difference to kind of start to pull apart the pieces and figure out what next steps I could take. And I couldn't have done it without that help. And some of it's just, also being involved with things, because even early on, I got involved with things that had to do with helping other people. Like I worked at Loaves and Fishes on as a volunteer and then as staff. Doing the Shakespeare thing, you know, things that were giving back were critical in building a sense of my own capabilities and worth.
Right. You became an agent in your life rather than a victim.
Yeah.
Cool. So what was the question, or what ended up being the question that could hold you to write a dissertation?
Okay.
And maybe that's not where we are allowed to go, but that's
it. No, that's fine. Yeah. It did change. You know, part of it was that, let me see, it did change, but it still had to do with basically women's health and reproductive and sexual health. And because I have been working in that field here, I wanted to do something internationally. And what I was really motivated to do is, I believe that you can, you mentioned the word triangulation earlier. Maybe we were off the air. I don't remember.
No, we were talking about, that's something you learn to do in families.
Yes.
With lots of kids.
And you do it. It helps when you're looking at evidence to be able to kind of look. It develops some depth, and it gives you more of a sense of why things happen the way
they
happen.
Two eyes triangulate
exactly,
an object. Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
And so if you can do that with a culture, so if I can look at, let's say, the contraception and abortion debates in the United States, and, you know, to not shy away from a hot button topic, and then
that's
you
where
go
I did my undergraduate thesis on reproductive choices around abortion, child rearing, and gendered roles.
We have to talk. Anyway, so I'm obviously, you know, in the thick of it here and aware of what's going on and interested and involved, and then I was able to go to Delhi, India, and look at, well, how is it different there? What are people doing? What are they learning? What are the barriers? What are ways that they are coping and doing things well and differently? And in fact, I learned so much. And I was saying to you earlier, I think off the air, that one of the things you're doing is you're doing kind of like a deep listening to get to know people in Ithaca. I did semi-structured interviews, and I did ethnographic participation, et cetera, along with some other, you know, documents and some triangulation with newspaper and media.
Right. Archival material.
Yep. And even current material. Mm-hmm. And I was able to find some really, really interesting areas of current and historical differences in the way that we put these ideas together, because as human beings in cultures, we often assume that our culture is really either the natural one or the way it's done. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, this is human nature. But in fact, humans do things very, very differently. And you can really develop a deeper understanding of what we do and also how to change things and possibly even improve them if you get a sense of how they can be different in right. different places
just,
and contexts.
Just a little bit of a sense.
Yeah. So that was, wow. And I went over there very conscious that of, you know, colonial history and mm-hmm. being an American and that I was probably going to get a dressing down. There are times when I did. And it was fine because I would also just reassure people, I am not coming in as an American telling you what to do mm-hmm. or that we do it right. I'm listening and I want to know what your experience is. So.
Well, I want to ask a kind of a reflective question. What have you had to learn about yourself? There is such clear sense of purpose and presence in the way you are here. What have you had to learn about yourself that you would not have anticipated or necessarily chosen, but has been very important to the life you live now?
I might have alluded, this is just one thing, there's probably many others, but earlier when I was talking about my mentors sure. and their patience with me, but also kind of holding me to account, this is so interesting because now in my 50s, I am aware of the intensity and heat of the way I approached questions when I was much younger and the impatience. And I still have a lot of that fire, but at the same time, I think it's really important. And I've had many experiences now of having to either slow down or purposefully slowing down and considering a completely antithetical viewpoint mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. let's say something I very strongly believe in. If people haven't figured it out by now, I'm extremely pro-choice and I'm extremely feminist, and that also includes that I love children and men and families, etc. mm-hmm. And I think that's all compatible, but I do slow myself down and I regularly try to open my mind understand the position that someone might take about, for instance, being anti-abortion. Mm-hmm. And even though that is, you know, I strongly don't feel we should legislate that way, if someone truly has a deeply held conviction about life and it reflects in their position socially and how they approach families mm-hmm. and people who are low income, etc. If they are, you know, lifting up people out of their concern for life, then I have a lot of respect for them. Mm-hmm. And I want to lay down my tension and my defenses and just, witness who they are.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe that's, I think that's an example of what you're talking about. And I couldn't do that when I was younger. I was a little fireball.
Right. And I mean, at some point we accept the moral agency of others who differ from us.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's been very sad for me, having kind of spent some time, I had not anticipated, didn't know we were going to talk about this issue, but, we framed it as a woman's right to privacy and choice based in privacy, and we've framed it as a right to life. For most Americans, it's a matter of equity or fairness. And almost no one questions that it's ultimately the woman's right to choose, but in an equitable situation, there may be other people, such as grandparents, who could help out, or might want to help out, or might not want to help out, and that information should be, in some sense, part of the process. Mm-hmm. The moral decision isn't necessarily the legal decision.
Mm-hmm.
But coming at it from an equity point of view, there's a lot more agreement on this issue than when you frame it as a private choice versus a right to life.
Right.
That's going to polarize everything. And
right.
we have not been able to get out of that to have these much more subtle conversations where you can do exactly what you've done with the extreme position, which is respect people for what they're striving to do.
Right.
And to create spaces where they get to work on that agenda as long as they're not manipulating anybody.
Right.
Or abusing them.
Yeah.
And that is there's power there. We haven't tapped that in this country in our politics around reproduction, abortion, sexuality, child rearing.
Right.
Because they're all a bundle. We want to treat them separately, but they are a bundle of interrelated issues. Pardon me, I'm on a soapbox.
No, that's right.
We are also kind of coming. What changed in you to be able to say, you know, I can be a fireball. I have been a fireball. I don't need to be a fireball. I don't even necessarily have the, I'm imagining in your 50s, I don't have the energy to be a fireball. Now, when did that awareness come into your life and how did you begin to wear it?
Interesting. Well, I think some of it, honestly, is a little bit, I don't have the energy to fight all the time, to fight everything and everyone.
Yeah.
And also realizing that the fighting actually doesn't get you any closer to a livable, sustainable, long-term positive result for the most people. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, there's this thing about calling out culture versus calling in culture. And I'll just sum up that, I mean, when people are like, they spot something going on that's negative and they're calling someone out and it's humiliating.
Right.
It's as shame-based. Opposed to later going to someone and saying, hey, you know what? I was thinking, you know, I used to think like that sometimes, but here's what this friend of mine told me or this experience I went through or saw and it changed me. And I'd like to talk to you about it. And that's a little harder to do maybe than to just lash out. But lashing out just creates these polarizations.
Well, and there are personalities who find it almost constitutionally impossible to lash out. They aren't built for that kind of conflict.
Mm.
There are other people for whom that's almost the default position.
Yeah.
So who has to work and who has to do for whom it's easier is
that's
different
interesting.
Question. That's been my experience. But it also means that you're making the claim that people are more important than issues.
Yes.
My relationship with you as a human being is more important than where we come down on an issue. And we must pursue this difference in a way that allows us to be at peace with each other as people, even if we may do things that we find patently offensive.
Yeah. Well, and so that also, I think, ties into one of the reasons why I was dedicated and interested in going back to graduate school and working on these issues is because on a certain level, I used to feel like if I could just, you know, get as much evidence and make the right argument, it would be clear. I would be able to push things in a certain direction or help the outcome become X, Y, or Z. And frankly, there's so much kind of fog and confusion that's created by all this intellectual bantering, and there's a lot of ego involved in it. And being, you know, the last few years up at Cornell really knocked the stuffing out of me for a number of reasons. Part of it was because I was watching what was going on among some of my colleagues and some of the competition, even though I also love my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
But when I finished, after much, you know, tooth gnashing, more because of some of the things that were, you know, just kind of going around and because of the difficulties in academia in some ways these days, I got out and I was like, I need to get back to meditation. And I know you said something about asking about how you take care
of
yourself.
This is the segue.
And you know, I really am working on just kind of, you know, we train our bodies, we train our intellects, but sometimes we need to just train where our minds go, because mine sometimes will tend to get into some sort of a loop or a fury or a, you know, hardworking, too many plates in the air, rolling around on sticks, etc., whatever the metaphor. And to be able to slow down and drop back down into my body as a human being and a mammal,
mm-hmm.
and recognize, you know, in my relationships with other people too, to let go of some of that noise and some of those overlays, and to recognize the basic human needs and well-being of each other it really brings down a lot of the noise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it bring it also you can train your mind in compassion, which sounds strange, but why not? You know,
well, yeah, I mean, you can train your mind to slow it down, to acknowledge a prejudice or a judgment that comes and to let it go.
Yeah.
I want to spend a little just a bit with this, and then I want to talk about what you do. But you can also calm your body,
yep,
and calm your emotions in such a way that if you are physically at peace, where you can see accurately what's going on, your feelings are clear and not, and you understand them, and your body is not tense or anxious, you are the embodiment of hope.
Mm.
Because in that moment, you can respond to what is without projection, without
absolutely
fear, without anxiety. And we don't aspire to that. But if we are there, then we will more quickly discover what the problem is, or perhaps even what a solution or a response,
yes,
is that would be helpful.
Right.
Because we're not anxious.
And sometimes the real solution we can offer is the space for that other person who is going through whatever they're going through,
right,
to be heard, acknowledged, witnessed, and then their solution emerges.
Right, and for them to have the time to discern whether this is something they must change or must accept.
Yep.
Or something in between. So the way we close this show, which we're getting down close to,
wow,
is what do you do on a regular basis to take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically? How do you know you need to do it? Through the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly? I mean, what do you do for self-care?
Okay, well, I'm gonna take this question and run in a different direction after I tell you that,
sure,
one of the things I do is I swim.
Yeah.
And I swim like either a frog or a jellyfish, and I like it. And
good.
It feels good. And that's one thing. And another thing is just recently, I did take some time off from work, and I was looking for potential work in other places, which I decided against. And during that time, I ended up working on this project with kids at GIAC in the after-school program. And I worked with another artist. I asked this other artist, I don't know if you know Terry Plater.
Yep.
And, oh, I told you about this. And anyway, I brought some of those pictures, but I'll show them to you later.
Sure.
And I'm so excited that, so the show was inspired by Black Lives Matter. And as this movement was heating up, I was thinking, what can I do as an ally that is giving back something? And I talked to Terry and I met with the GIAC folks and they let us come in. And basically what resulted is that these kids ages 7 to 10 in the after school program did a lot of drawings and paintings of black, brown, and tan people that we know and love, including Nina Simone. And the Tompkins County Public Library is going to have the exhibit for 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And it was just in Gimme Coffee for the month of May. And just seeing the kids just jump into this and seeing, you know, encouraging them and just giving them enough little bit of support that their own capabilities came out and their eyes lit up. I have to say it ended up almost feeling kind of selfish because it was so fun. And so that really does take care of me.
Right. Well, the experience of joy or delight,
yeah,
feeds a person.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it can be an addictive drug or it can be, yeah, just the experience of watching.
And the GIAC staff, the teachers that we worked with were so helpful and supportive. And I ended up making more friends. It was one of the reasons, one among many, many reasons why I decided to stay in Ithaca. It's just, okay, darn it, I'm making new friends. I can't move away. So that's kind of... I know, I stole the question and ran with it.
No, but this is a major turning point in your life. You're done. There's no reason, children, school, there's no reason to stay here except that you choose to.
Yeah.
And you found a way to choose.
Yeah.
And that happens maybe on a decades basis. That's not a, although
Avery surely is tempting me. I mean, he's not actively tempting me, but he's out on the West Coast and he's doing really well. And, you know, we communicate all the time and part of me wants to follow him there, but I'm not sure if he's going to stay there long term.
Right.
And also he's a young adult. He doesn't need his mom to live, you know, right near him.
Right. Right. And so, you've got years.
Yeah, exactly.
For that to play out.
Exactly.
Is there anything that you do on a daily basis, other than the swimming, to take care of yourself, or how do you know when you need a reality check or a attitude fix?
Interesting.
Well,
I do have a couple friends whose mission it is, and it's a mutual mission, to be a reality check with either a crazy idea or a big idea or a grumpy mood. You know, people who can actually say, like, come on, or, you know, that's a little bit, you know, what are you saying? Or, wow, yeah, I agree with you. People who are honest with you. So that's mm-hmm. a big thing.
And that is a conscious commitment to each other's well-being.
Yes.
That's a covenant relationship.
Yes. Yeah. And then I also, you know, I have a couple friends who I'm really affectionate with, and I have a, you know, funny little partner and just major mammal cuddling and watching, yeah. you know, some sort of, you know, mind-easing show
sure,
where you can
sure.
just, and drinking tea at night and just that kind of, and walking around. My God. This is a great
place to walk
around.
This is the one people overlook. I love to walk, and I'll walk 2 or 3 or 6 miles if
yes.
I can. But that is great exercise,
yeah.
and it's peace-giving.
Yeah, and we just are very fortunate to be in this area. I mean, talk about being enamored with the natural world. You know, I've traveled a lot, but this, you know, there's not much that can compete with how lucky and beautiful, how lucky we are.
So, Em, what song should we close with today?
Oh, gosh.
Because we have three that we haven't got, or four, actually, and one that was your singing.
Oh, well, why don't we do me singing? I wrote this song for Avery when I was driving to TC3 to nursing school, and he was sitting in the little car seat next to me.
And this is you and...
John Simon and, was playing on guitar.
Okay. Okay, and shall I just play it and you'll sing in or?
No, just play it because I am already singing on it and just we can turn our mics off.
Okay, okie doke. Thank you, Em. It's been great to get to know you.
Thanks.
Little boy thinks he's a dog, so I scratch him behind the ears. He wags his tail and howls at the moon, and he hasn't had a bath in years. I know a little girl, she thinks she's a lion. She's tawny and fierce, and her name is O'Brien. She gnaws real mean on a bagel and cheese, and she hasn't had a bath in years. Another little kid, he thinks he's a snake, curling around that chocolate cake. Well, I'll leave him alone for my own sake, because he hasn't had a bath in years. Three wild animals under my table. I'm feeling kind of hungry, but I am unable to enjoy a quiet meal at the end of a day. And I think a bath will be the only way. Ah-oo-rars. What's a body to do? I put my feet up, take a sip from my cup, and keep one eye on my little zoo stew. The doggy howls at the bathroom moon. Slippery snake in a soapy monsoon. The lion roars and the bubbles fly, and I slurp my soup under a starry sky. Ah-oo-rars. What's somebody to do? I put my feet up, take a sip from my cup, and keep one eye on my little zoo stew.